From multiple new and familiar locations in Minneapolis or near enough, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development.
I'm Ellen Burns Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor,
and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy, I too make nice games. For this week's episode, our topics are novelty and intuition. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start.
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 Oh, it's like a bunch of runners on a starting line, and like it's one psyching the others out. Like
I was literally ready to get up and pounce.
I was like totally thrown off.
Yeah.
One day I'll just surprise you guys with a starting gun.
Yeah.
Just pull it up on camera and just blast it into the mic.
Oh, goodness, that's hilarious. So I got a new keyboard.
Yeah.
It's a split keyboard. It's I'll link it in the show notes, but I think it's called a Matthias Ergo Pro.
Yeah.
Kind of a weird thing. So basically what it did, they took a regular keyboard without the numpad and they cut it in half.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can just, you know, you connect it to some wires and you can type on it split up like that. And it's kind of nice because like my arms are not close together as I'm typing.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel like I'm squishing up against myself as much. It feels like, Mark, you described it like as a Joy-Con.
Yeah.
Like the two Joy-Cons thing. That
only came to me because I know how much you love that control scheme. And so this makes a lot of sense that you want a keyboard that works the same way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my ultimate goal with this was to make more space on my desk, and I don't think I actually achieved that goal. But
you don't have like a place for your coffee or tea in the center?
I moved some stuff over, so now I have like a place where I can like pick up stuff from my left side.
Yeah.
Kind of neat.
I like the idea of getting, maybe there's a split keyboard out there where the right half does have a number pad, and then the left one has like a cup holder.
Yeah. Yeah. Can we get Ergo Extra Pro? Right.
Yeah.
What's kind of surprised me about yours, yours has a great, the cable between the two parts is, it's like, it's extendo, right? There's a term for it, but like it has no slack ever, which is kind of cool. But I've seen other ones that have a little like a telephone cable or a coiled kind of, or a headphone kind of cable as a way to sort of do something similar. And the thing that always confuses me a little bit is there's no reason a computer can't have multiple keyboards attached via Bluetooth or something. So why are these not just separate devices? Like, why is there a cable at all? You have to do two radios into the thing. It'd be a little pricey, but it's a small market. Yeah. You could make them pricey.
Well, this isn't a Bluetooth keyboard either. It's
connected. Oh, okay. Okay, so that alone
That's probably why. And yeah, maybe it's to cut costs. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I imagine creating these kind of keyboards maybe are probably more expensive than regular keyboards.
Well, how much does this one cost
maybe
you?
I want to say it was like $100.
Okay. Well, in the keyboard world, that's not too bad.
No, it's not. Also, this keyboard is quiet, which I like. I do not like loud keyboards. I know that's a controversial opinion. Mechanical clickety clacks, but I don't want to do that.
Just the way you said that.
Like, yeah, I know.
Just no respect for clickety clacks. Yeah.
No,
get your clickety clacks off my desk.
I did, because this keyboard does not have a numpad. I did have to get a separate numpad for it, which also made the whole make more room on my desk thing not really happen.
Yeah,
but the numpad that I have is super loud. Like, I'm gonna type on it now.
Yeah,
look at how obnoxious.
Are you a person that needs a numpad?
I do like having a numpad. I specifically got the key or the laptop I got because it has a numpad.
Yeah.
It's like a gaming laptop. Yeah. So I really, I just really enjoy that. And like, I had this thing for like a week or two without a numpad, and I would keep reaching over to get to the numpad. I was like, oh, it's not there. And then it would just make me annoyed. So
yeah.
I'll just spend the 10, 20 bucks or whatever and get a numpad.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It sounds like you designed this for a specific purpose. It has failed that purpose, but you're pretty happy anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, yeah.
That's, I mean, that's a great outcome. Like,
I wonder if the stretchy boy cable is there so that kids don't walk off with one half of your keyboard and you're left with like just an empty space on your desk and some questions.
Mm.
That's a good point. That would not be great if like, the left half of my keyboard just wasn't.
I mean, I didn't really think of that, but like my default mode, unlike Ellen, is not mischief. So
Dale's is, though.
That's true. I live with a mischief maker. I should know right. better. Ellen, it says here you have not played many games lately. This is a thing you want to process on the show?
Sure. Therapy corner. Yeah, so I am a person who crams too much stuff in their schedules. Always. I know this about myself. I still can't help it. It's always a surprise to me, like, oh, how did I get so busy? Why do I feel so tired? And then I'm like, oh, because I did this and then I did this and then this, you know, and I feel bad that I didn't get to this, even though it's 10 p.m. and I've worked a full day and then did another thing. Yeah. Anyway, so I have been kind of kicking myself for not working in a lot of time for games between just regular work stuff and some family stuff that happened recently. And then also I'm just like attacking the landscaping in our yard, which has been kind of languishing for the last couple years. We took down a tree because it was going to fall on our house. Oh, we took it down before it could actually fall on the house.
That'll show it.
Yeah. Oh, it's a bummer. It made me so sad. It was a big tree, and that's kind of sad, but not as sad as I would be if it fell on my house.
Right.
So I've just been spending a lot of time outside digging up plants and putting new plants in and digging up rocks and putting them back down. And when I put it that way, it doesn't sound like a lot of work. It's a hell of a lot of work.
Right.
So, I don't know. I think we've talked about this on the show. Like, sometimes games can recharge you and sometimes they can drain you. And depending on what's going on, like, it's one or the other. And for me, I'm getting some good community, like, group game in time in on Thursdays and then sometimes on Saturdays with you guys. And that's enough for now. But every time I'm picking up a weed, I'm like, oh, I could be playing a game.
Yeah.
So.
And I mean, I think you talked about this on the show before, too. But it's, like, weird when you're, like, in the industry of games, too, because it just feels like you don't have as much time or drive to play games.
Yeah.
And it's just counterintuitive because, all you know, playing games is also research. If you're in the game, if you're in the games industry. So, like, you have to play games to keep up to date, but you also need to spend time making games, which is not anywhere near as fun as playing games in a lot of cases. So, it's like, you got to split your focus and stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, I feel you on that.
There's been a lot of, there's a long-running debate of, like, should game developers be gamers? Like, should they... And we've talked about this on the show before, but like I saw a tweet recently that was really interesting from a writer who said, like, writers focus a little bit too much on structure when actually it's not that hard and not that important. And I thought that was a really interesting thing because you think about a lot of art and like the sort of the craft of it, like the real, like a lot of the rules and like, how do you make something good? How does it make something so effective? And writers deal with this a lot, like especially like screenwriters. And there's like the push and pull between like the right way versus the chaos way or whatever. And I've never heard it phrased that way, that it's not that hard and it's not that important. And I feel that's really true because like some of the best work that's ever been made in the world has been by people who have no idea what they're doing. And then the rest of their life, they chase that again. Like there's some magic to it. And that's a dangerous thing to say because I believe in, I'm a technocrat. I believe in skill and process and logistics, but at the same time, when I think about that in terms of like game developing, I sometimes feel like, you know what? It's okay to not know some stuff. Like it's okay to not know what the, you know, not that you want to be reinventing the wheel or anything, but like, it's fine that you didn't include that feature. Like it's that you didn't even know it was a good idea. You didn't even know that that's how the genre you're playing in is expected anymore. I mean, it gives you some challenges. It's, you know, obviously it's a whole different for marketing, whatever, but I think I hope game developers don't feel so guilty about not doing the research by playing all the latest whatevers.
Yeah, for sure.
So just keep picking up and putting down those rocks and you're good.
Yep. I got all the big ones done, so.
Now it's just little pebbles and stuff you gotta...
Gotta put in some plants. I'm making a little butterfly garden up front, so I'm gonna put in some plants next weekend that'll be good for butterflies to eat.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I think there's... Sometimes you just got to do what your brain wants you to do. And right now my brain wants me to dig in the dirt, look at bugs and make food for butterflies. And I'm, you know, I'm just going to lean into that. So the conclusion of this therapy corner was I'm going to allow myself not to play games.
Mm-hmm.
Huge sacrifice.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to dig in the dirt and save some grubs.
Cool. well, that's all fine, but it means you're going to miss out on Mass Effect Legendary Edition, which I'm just I'm just about to dive into. And I'm like, oh, that'll be fun. And I'm like, oh, wait, that's three games. Oh, no.
I've been watching some gameplay of it, and I am reminded on how slow the first game starts.
Yeah.
I forgot. It takes a while before you get to the actual fun stuff. And by fun stuff, controversial opinion, I mean the Maiko.
Yeah.
Talking about the six-wheeled behemoth that drove around in all the moons and junk.
I'm with you, Steven.
This is a 100% pro Maiko podcast. We're all, I loved Maiko. I loved how dumb it was. I loved everything about it.
Yeah. And I think it takes like 3 hours before you actually get to do any of that stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, gear up for that then, I guess, Mark.
I spent so much time just trying to see if I could get that to go over a bump. Like, here's an interesting looking polygon in the distance. Let's see if I can jump it.
Yeah!
I tried to climb up vertical walls so frequently in that game.
Right, yeah.
Because I think you couldn't flip it over. There was the game just wouldn't let you flip it backwards because of how silly that was. But you got to get really close a lot.
Yeah.
It was great.
Good stuff. And then, and they're supposed to have changed it in the Legendary Edition, right? So I'd be curious.
Like a lot of games, that you can toggle it on and off, apparently. So you can make it bounce around like the Mako of old. Or you can make it feel a little more like a tug in the road, like a real vehicle on a plate in a place. Like, but honestly, who wants that?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
You're driving a giant truck on an alien planet where there are no roads. It's going to feel bumpy. Come on.
Yeah. Bounce or bust. That's
what I see. Yeah. Yeah, there should be more science fiction that depicts variable gravity worlds, because I think it looks silly and we need to get used to that.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Well, I have been watching The Expanse, and that's absolutely a thing that they do in that series. Yeah. Is they take gravity into account in all sorts of different situations, but they have not so far in my watching or reading of the series gotten up to any real hijinks in vehicles on planets. Mm-hmm. So we'll still have to rely on Commander Shepard for that.
Speaking of Mako, I don't know where I'm going with this. Novelty is my topic.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's a new, new steering.
Yep.
Novel. Whatever. You had a better one.
Yeah, I did. I guess. Sure. Let's pretend I did. And use that and move on to this new topic. Novelty. That's my topic. I wanted to talk about novelty, I guess, because it's something that's brought up a lot in our circles. And so I guess the first thing I want to do is really just define what novelty is.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily something that's new, because like when you first release a game, it's a new game. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
it's a feature that like hasn't really been seen before, or it rarely has been seen before.
Mm-hmm.
So like to take Fingence, for example, the co-op shoot 'em up gameplay where like, you know, we've got like RPG elements in it and stuff like that. That is a novelty of Fingence. That is something that isn't really seen in a lot of games. But the shoot 'em up gameplay is not novelty, right? Like that's in a bajillion and two games.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's all over the place. Another example, Widget Satchel has the collectible weight puzzles, and really just like how you maneuver the space, knowing that like if you get too many things, you can't jump as high or move as fast. That aspect of it is novelty. Though even I don't know how much we emphasize it in the marketing. I feel like we
emphasize it almost none at all.
I mean, to be fair, the game has a lot of stuff in it, including ferrets and explosions. And I feel like ferrets and explosions are a little bit higher.
It's a little bit easier to sell that. Down. Yeah. But yeah. To speak to that, not to go on too much a tangent. One of the I went to a lot of GDC talks and watched a lot of things online about how to sell your indie game. And one of the lessons I really took to heart was this idea of like, there's what your game is, and then what's the hook for your game, and it's never the same thing. So when we were sort of getting ready to release Widget Satchel, I was very keen on thinking like the weight mechanic is what's new and novel, but I couldn't imagine that selling the game, because it's hard to explain, and it's hard to convince someone that they even want it. Because it's a mechanism to frustrate the player ultimately. Mm-hmm. So the doohickeys, the different tools, and the fact that and the sort of the nonviolent Metroidvania light qualities, which are interesting but not as I would say not as foundational to the core mechanics of the game as the weight system is. That became more of a focus of it. I don't know if that was the right decision, but it definitely something I thought about a lot. Like, I didn't lean on the novelty when we wrote that copy, you know?
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah.
And Ellen, you wrote some of that too. Like, I mean, I think we had those discussions about like what was important about what to say about the game.
Yeah, and I think I convinced you that it was explosions.
Yes.
That had been a long campaign, like months.
I recall, I seem to believe that now, so it's a success.
I'm glad you brought up that, Mark, because like I think that yeah, just because something is novel in your game doesn't necessarily mean that that is a benefit towards, like, you know, it doesn't necessarily benefit the marketing of the game, but it can be, you know, something exciting.
Yeah.
So, like, if you're not, if a novelty aspect of your game is exciting and you think people will be excited about it, then yeah, definitely like highlight that. I think, you know, there was a period of time where games were a lot of like browns and grays and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So like when we started adding more color palettes into our games, I think a lot of those games highlighted that. I know that like a big draw of what's the game where you're like trying to create a star and you roll a ball around? Katamari Damacy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I figured it out as I was talking. That was, you know, a very cute and colorful game. And I think a lot of the marketing highlighted that, because I think that was, at the time, I think that came out on PS2, right? There were a mm-hmm. lot of like really edgy, quote unquote, or dark, quote unquote, games coming out at the time. And so, like, you know, seeing that game out with all those other things was a novel feature of it. And I think that helped it grow an audience, because a lot of people, you know, were interested in that kind of stuff.
That's a real interesting approach to the definition of novelty, which isn't necessarily something new that's never been seen before. It's something new in the context of the space.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the brown and gray, like the war games, you know, like it's not that we haven't had colorful shooters prior to that, but releasing one in that time would be novel.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right, right, right. And so like, yeah, so it's kind of weird, like the way that novelty works, because it's not like I said, it's not a new thing. It's just a thing that like feels like you haven't really seen it in a long time. It's something that feels like it's new, feels like it's newer than it maybe is.
It's a playful nudge against expectations.
Yeah,
yes, or maybe more than a nudge, but it starts with that.
Yeah,
yeah, against expectations. So yeah, that's good. That's a good description. I like that. Another benefit of novelty is, like, you know, you're exploring a new space. Potentially, if this is like a truly new feature, or I guess if it's not, like if a lot of games have just been exploring this kind of a thing, you know, you explore, like there's a ton of like roguelikes out now, but there aren't a lot of 4X games. I play a lot of Civ. I play too much Civ, and that's probably why I'm bringing this up now. there aren't a lot of 4X games. So like, new games coming out that are, you know, exploring what a 4X game is, you know, allows you to explore fancy different things that other previous 4X games have not explored.
Mm-hmm.
And because it feels like a new thing, you can use that to your advantage, describe stuff. Another benefit of novelty is like people will be extra hyped because it's like something new. A lot of times people like new stuff or things they haven't really seen before or haven't seen a lot of.
Yeah.
So
right, there's the marketing of it, but also when I boot up the game to play, that excitement of it being new or different, independent of what it took to me to buy the thing. That's a way to, and the novelty is by definition then fleeting.
Yep.
Right?
It totally is. Right, right, right. Like, well, I mean, you brought up Mass Effect, right? The first Mass Effect was very novel, because I don't think there were a lot of RPGs set in a space opera sort of world.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, but by the time that this game is coming out now, there has been 4 Mass Effect games and a bunch of other games that have taken place in space, and they have that sort of stuff, and a bunch of Star Wars movies and like new Star Trek movies.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of space stuff going on. Even Marvel has space stuff now. So like it doesn't feel as novel as it did back then.
Yeah.
like when Mass Effect first came out, there was a bunch of hype for it because, you know, it was a new space thing. Mm-hmm. Space things are cool. So like people were hyped for it, and it helps you like feel good about like what you're working on, because like people see you at a conference or something, or they'll, you know, watch a trailer at E3 or whatever, and they go, "Oh wow, space thing! I like space."
Yeah,
you know. I don't know.
I mean, I'm laughing, but that's totally my reaction to that stuff. Like,
yeah, mine too.
Exactly. I think like some of the downsides of novelty though is like, because you haven't explored the space, or because like people haven't explored the space as much, or they haven't explored it as recently, it's not necessarily as modern. It's like uncharted. Like, mm-hmm. you won't be able to like Google how to make really fun shooter, you know,
mm-hmm.
You're not making a shooter. If you're making something really very different.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point, you know, we've got a lot of games out there where you can certainly like find a bunch of different games that were maybe unique back in the day that aren't seen as much now, and you can learn some insights from that. But those games might be older, and they're not as modern, so mm-hmm. like they might have made some decisions that certainly wouldn't, they may not have been, that might not be made today.
Yeah.
That's something to look out for. And also new things are scary sometimes. So like it might actually like alienate some people in the audience. Like people like comforting things, and that's why like people keep making the same stuff.
Yeah.
Comfortable. And it's not necessarily a bad thing to have that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think that like seeking out novelty can be good, but it isn't necessarily something that you always have to go out for, because new things aren't always better. They're just new, and they're just sometimes different. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think it's possible? Well, I mean, this actually shakes loose a few ideas for me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like our brains are wired really to respond to novelty. So things that are new in your environment, like are important for some reason. That's what we have. That's our operating system and the way that it's set up, because new things are potentially dangerous, or they're potentially like, I found a pile of berries and I can eat them. And
yeah.
Share them, you know, good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we are wired to pay attention to novelty, but then if it isn't lasting, if it isn't interesting in a lasting way, then it soon just becomes part of the background.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I think we'll get into this again from a different angle when we talk about intuition later in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
But the novelty is something I often am chasing with games, right? So I have genres that I do like, but I like playing everything because I like the novelty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then I just dump games pretty fast these days. Once I feel like I'm getting the gist of it, and it's like, okay, I've gotten the gist of it. Does this have lasting fun beyond the novelty?
Mm-hmm.
And often the answer is no, and I just uninstall it. and that's an interesting thing to think about, because it makes me ask the question, you know, what is that recipe, or what characteristics do games have when those games are able to pass that novelty curve into lasting fun? And I think one of the pieces of that recipe for success, at least for me as a player, is the novelty isn't just front-loaded.
Yeah. Like,
there's meaningful moments of that fun surprise throughout the game. And what comes to mind right now is Breath of the Wild, like those little Korok puzzles. Those felt like novelty to me, sprinkled in throughout the game. There were so many of them, so it's not like they were new, but they were often put in places that made you think, oh, I didn't expect there to be one, or like, oh, I bet there's one over there. No, there is, you know, and it's a new one. What kind would it be?
Right.
Like, that, I think, was a good example of pulling in novelty throughout the entire game.
I just want to stay on that for a bit, because one of the things about Korok puzzles that are interesting is that when I played the game, I told myself I'm not going to find all these because it's not going to be fun to find them all. But the system is kind of designed for that. It's like if there's like, okay, so Assassin's Creed, you got to pick up all the feathers, right? Or whatever, one of the old Assassin's Creed games. Each one is a challenge, and you don't know where they all are, and it actually takes some work it's a task to go find them. That's pretty expected. That's to get the secrets to collect the things. You got to go find the puzzle pieces or whatever. But in Breath of the Wild, you stumbled upon these things all the time. And so that's what was novel about it. Even though the mechanic is like super simple, the challenges to collect them sometimes when there were very, some of them were kind of janky or even broken, but like it didn't matter because like this is that below the surface novelty. Everything about Breath of the Wild uses the existing language of games. It invented pure invention. There's very little new in there, but the way it was assembled and the whole of it, that's such a good example because I've been trying to, people always talk about how unique it is. And I'm like, if you really break it down to its pieces, there's nothing new in that game, but that's not the way to think about it. Right.
Right. Yeah. The whole collaborative became a novelty as a result of, you know, the sum of the pieces made it that way. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really all of the individual things that made it that way. Well, I mean, arguably, there was the whole weapon breaking thing. I don't know how novel that is, but people didn't like that. So,
right.
Even though I feel like that's core to the game and the game would not work without it, people didn't like it.
There are opinions, yeah. So,
yeah, there are.
That's another question. Is novelty a positive?
It isn't always. I think that it sometimes is not. And I think you bring up a very good point, Ellen, because I think that a lot of times, like the novelty will be front loaded or the novelty will be like, all that the game kind of is
for its own sake.
I mean, yeah, and that's fine because like it might end up being the case that like you know you figured out this novel thing and you wanted to explore the space and the space you explored feels like it wasn't very shallow or it ends up being shallow, and that is okay. Like you could just make that like small experience in that time. But I think that sometimes people will take novelty or like games will take a novelty and make it a whole thing and make it like 200 levels of content when like you really could have just stuck with like 50 solid things and gotten the point after a while. So because like novelty wears off over time, like as you're playing the game, you know, you'll start getting the point where like, oh, I get it now. But then you're like, there's, you know, another 150 levels you've got to complete. And you're like, well, I'm not going to waste my time doing all this and then you just fall off of it.
Yep.
And that's not fun for the developer or the player. So,
no.
So it can be potentially more harmful than good in some cases.
I see a lot of mobile games make that mistake. Even ones that are made by like big names, like Pokemon Quest. I was playing that for a while, which is very like general audience friendly, and you have little, you know, it plays on the whole idea that kids like cubes these days. So you have these little cube Pokemon, you run around a cube island, and you're fighting other cube Pokemon and catching cube things and
doing that
stuff. And it was pretty great until basically like they unlocked this entire island and I could go anywhere, but I didn't quite have the levels I needed to for Pokemon. It was just like, okay, well, this is a grind now and I don't really want that anymore. What was fun up to that point was like being able to use different combinations of Pokemon and have them do different things. But about like at a certain point in the game, it was just, I had the complete picture of all the tools. I felt like I had the complete picture of all the tools that were available to me to beat the rest of the game. And it just wasn't enough. And I picked up like a random ant game earlier today. It's just a prime example. And I got through the tutorial and it was like, okay, now go do your thing. And it's like, but this isn't fun anymore. You've just given me like a checklist. And it's like, they rely upon that novelty, especially like the novelty of the theme so heavily that once you get past it, there's just, it feels like there's nothing there, even though there probably is. And if I were to maybe push through the feeling of loss that I am working through after the novelty wears off, if I push through that, there probably is there's like a lot of fun to be had and good gameplay in there.
Mm-hmm.
But that novelty wearing off is such a disappointment that I just don't work past it. I'll just go install the next game, get past the novelty curve with that one, and then just go install the next one, I guess.
Yeah.
Until I find something that really has staying power.
Yeah.
For better or worse. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe that makes me a quitter.
No, I don't think so. I think that just, like, I don't know. My brother kind of is the same way. He'll be playing a whole bunch of new things all the time, and he gets on my nerves because sometimes he'll be like, hey, you want to play this game? And I'll be like, no. And then he'll be like, hey, do you want to play this game? And I'll be like, no. And it's the same thing over and over again. It's just a constant stream of Charles trying to get me to play games. yes, I'm calling you out on stream. He can say it about it when he's on the show.
He just wants to hang out with his brother.
How dare he ask you?
He wants to share a passion. How could you, Steven?
We can watch TV. I like TV. We can watch TV. It doesn't have to be a game.
You heard it, folks. Steven does not like games. He likes TV.
You guys want to come over and dig in my garden?
Well, you said you moved a lot of the big rocks already, so sure.
Yeah.
Exactly. Now it's just the dirt.
But like he will play new games on. He tends to he plays some of them fully and some of them he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
He gets on his nerves, I guess. But like he does like trying to play new things and stuff a lot. But I do oftentimes hear Charles like describe this game and go like, wow, this game is too long, or I like what they were doing for a little bit, but then like I fell off of it pretty quick and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So like I think that like it's kind of hard too, because like when you're making a game, you want to make a fully fleshed out game and you want people to feel like they got their money's worth too. So it's like a difficult kind of balance to get.
Yeah.
To reach with this kind of stuff. And it's kind of weird too, because we're talking about things in generic terms, because novelty can mean so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's so many different ways you can be novel that it's difficult to like describe how to take the tool of novelty and use it the best, implement in your game, because like it's not really something you can do in that same way.
Yeah, it's not a recipe, it's very contextual.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And also audience dependent to a certain degree,
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's very true.
One of those things when you evaluate old work, and this is true of all mediums, is to like I've always said novelty for its own sake is overrated, but like the context is so important. And so you think about things that don't seem so interesting anymore or from before your time, and you have to really transport your mind back to the context in which it lived to understand the full of it,
Actually, that's a good point, because like novelty in some respects can just mean representation. Which is, I guess it's a different beast. We talked about it in previous shows, episodes in the past, but like that's a different thing, sort of, right?
Yeah.
Like when, if you decide you want to put, a non-binary character in your game or something, that's not novelty for the sake of novelty. It's a different kind of thing. And you're not describing that
30 years from now, it might feel really like a trite or basic.
Yeah.
It will be, right? That'll be true.
Mm-hmm.
A good example of this, get ready, is Star Trek. The Uhura, black woman on the bridge in a position of power. But that role was not very meaty for Nichelle Nichols, and she said that in the past. And so we look at that now, and we're like, what was the big deal? Like, isn't that kind of disrespectful, actually, to have someone on and not really give them a lot to do? But, and that's true. Like, that is true. Like, it's just, but also another thing is true, is that it was revelatory at the time. And so that doesn't absolve you from like the deficiencies we now see in it. That's a really good angle on it, the representation, and like novelty isn't just for like fun and surprise. Novelty could apply to any component of your world building or storytelling or presentation or business model or anything. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And that's why we have to talk about it in such generic terms, because it can just be, it can be anything.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I want to bring it back to like the games that we've been working on with respect to Fingence and novelty. Like, we wanted to make Fingence a team game. So like we built that to the core of it. And that's why it has those RPG-esque elements in it. We've got the three core roles, the trifecta or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You got the tanks, you got the damage dealers, you got the healers, mm-hmm. the supports. And we put that in there so like people can like get in there and not necessarily have to be super good at shoot 'em up gameplay, but also like still be able to contribute to a team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like that was important to us, because like also we weren't very good at shmups. I think my brother probably was, but me and Lane really didn't have a lot of experience with shoot 'em ups at the time. Like, we wanted to make it feel different, because like that isn't the shoot 'em up gameplay wasn't necessarily the thing we wanted to do. We felt like there was a lot of depth in shoot 'em up gameplay to make it team oriented. mm-hmm. In a way that like other games feel like didn't quite hit at as well.
So
like that's why we kind of approached it that way.
You know what I find
and
new,
it worked out.
You know what I find new about Fingence and is kind of beside that point a little bit, which is the RPG elements are meant to so you can build out a team, right? It's in service of the co-op mechanics. But what it does for me, and I imagine this is true for other players, is I'm more invested in my character. Not just because I can customize it, but because I have control over it in a way that's different from gameplay control over it. And so, you know, I think that when you're bad at a genre that has a real high difficulty curve, like a shoot 'em up, where like it takes you a little while to understand the basic language of it, so you're not just terrible, right? In Fingence, I think it's much quicker to become invested in the health and survival of this cute sub. The storytelling does a little bit of that work, but more than it is for other games that I might enjoy the settings or style or story from, because the mechanics bring me into it a little bit quicker in a way.
Right.
And that's a consequence of that. And that feels really new and interesting to me. I think that's probably why a lot of people who are not interested in shoot 'em ups just love Fingence.
Yeah. In a different respect, though, like we had some novelty in Widget Satchel. We talked about that a little bit. We have like the weight, the collectibles weight thing, where like as you collect more stuff, your sprocket slows down and jumps lower, or can't jump as high. And that is the reason why we have that in the game really is because like that was the core part of the game jam that we originally built Widget Satchel in. But we left it in there like because we felt like there was a lot of potential in there. And I think that over time, as we developed the game, we kind of steered away from that mechanic in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of it was just because like, I think you were saying, Mark, it ended up oftentimes frustrating the player in ways that like we didn't really want.
Well, we wanted it to be a puzzle generation machine. Right. We wanted that was our goal that's why we wanted to keep it. And we said, this is a great mechanic. We built three short levels in the jam, but we saw the potential to build a whole system of puzzles around this traversal puzzles, mechanical puzzles, sequencing stuff. You know, we really saw that. I think ultimately that ambition, like in terms of the way we did our workflow and the time we had to build it, I think that's why it felt we needed to move away from it a little bit. Is because I don't know that we could be super true to that. I still think we've talked about how the sequel, I think I've said to you, in a sequel, I think maybe we could drop that because there's enough else in that Widget Satchel as like a brand, as a franchise, that would be valuable. Not that anyone cares that much about holding on to those sorts of things, but like there's enough in that game that could survive into something else. It doesn't need that mechanic, even though it was core original. And I think you were saying, oh, but there was so much potential, I would love to try again. I can come on board with that. But we set a challenge for ourselves that, and then I don't know that we did get there, but I don't know that we got there as we did it as much as we would have wanted to. Right.
Yeah. That's kind of where I'm at. Yeah. Actually, that's a good point. Like with respect to like game jams and things, like there's a lot of novelty because like you're making a game and such a short period of time, there's a lot of things that you can try out and then just, you know, completely.
The risks are so low, so why not try something new and weird?
Well, I mean, y'all worked on a game jam recently, right? Mm-hmm. Did you feel like you approached some form of novelty with the game that you made?
Where are we going?
Oh gosh, I don't know if we did it on purpose, but I do feel like the team went into the jam with the shared understanding that we wanted to stay away from things that felt like low hanging fruit. Not to say that like a platformer or a shooter like easy to make, but conceptually it was straightforward, especially once we got the theme. That's why there are like lots and lots of digging games in the most recent Ludum Dare or Dare, however you want to pronounce it. but we wanted to do something that wasn't like the first idea that we picked up. And we picked up a lot of different takes on the theme and put them down and tossed them to the side until we came up on the one that we ended up using for Sonder, which was the idea of going deeper and deeper into memory. So I think perhaps on the theme, we did some novelty.
Well, we approached, we took the theme and we applied it to the story. And so I think that it freed us up to just make whatever. Like we weren't focused on novelty and mechanics. And I think also, I think we did a pretty good job of not building it out as if no one had ever made a game before ever. Because Ellen, you told us all, like, let's come up with a feeling we want to have. And we came to an agreement on that. And we said, okay, well, what do we make to do that? And I feel like we used very little of our existing languages, like in terms of, I mean, I think intuitively we did, but I think, and maybe just, is that making sense? Like, yeah. I think rather than like going for novelty, we just didn't bother with convention.
Sure. Yeah. Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly what I was thinking. We just didn't think about it. We didn't say, okay, so we want to do a game on memory and we're going to make it like a visual novel. Mm-hmm. We didn't do that. And what we came up with, I think, has lots of mechanics that are similar to some visual novels or some very narrative focused games with, you know, lots of object interaction, a little bit of those like 2D adventure stories. There's a little bit of that feeling. But the reason it might feel novel is because we didn't start with, we're going to build this kind of game. We started with, we're going to build a game that results in this experience.
Right.
And that led us to make decisions that may end up feeling novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that maybe that's just good advice for any team, whether you're going with something that's in an established genre or you're focusing only on story or you're focusing specifically on a great mechanic that you prototyped and you want to build a game around that is just come up with what you want it to do and then just make it do that. And then like, don't worry necessarily about trying too hard for novelty. And I think it can be very tempting to, oh, this is new and interesting, and then lean into it. And I guess I don't have an opinion. Maybe that's a good thing. When you notice that, reach for it. Or maybe when you notice that, just let it pass by and keep going. Like, I'm not really sure what the best practice is.
Depends.
There. I don't have good advice.
I don't think
there
is one. Yeah. I think it depends on the game that you're making and who you're making it. All that jazz. Which is everyone's favorite and least favorite answer is it depends.
Yeah.
But it does. Because, I don't know, novelty is contextual, right?
Like, right.
So it's something you have to rely upon your intuition to do.
Hey, folks. I know you like to listen to the show. It's your favorite thing. We know that for certain. That's an answered question. We know. You love us. But did you know there's other ways to engage with Nice Games Club? No, you didn't. I know that also for a fact.
For a fact.
Right. For example, we have the feedback form, which is where I get all these facts from. We also, of course, have our email address, which you can contact us directly. Let us know what we're doing, how we're doing.
Yeah.
You can get in touch with us on Twitter. Of course, you can be a patron, and we talk about that enough. And, you know, we also have a little Discord community that's really fun. Ellen, I hear that you have a little bit of a play-by-play, a little bit of a summary as to what's been going on lately in that little community.
When you said play-by-play, it made me feel like I have to take on, like, a sports reporter.
Yes, that's exactly what I meant. Yeah.
Well, you don't want to hear this. Let's see if I can do it. Oh, no. Well, okay, a couple weeks ago, what was happening at the left end of the field was we were talking about some game jam prompt ideas.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think the specific word that came up was, like, the turns have tabled. So I would love to do something on that later. But, oh, there's more action on the Discord.
What?
Look at the other guys coming from the other side of the field. You guys tell I don't sports much.
Yeah, I'm just enjoying how badly this is going. I'm getting a real kick out of it.
It's so terrible. Yes. Okay. So letting the shtick go because I wasn't holding onto it very well anyway. We have a lot of conversations with some of our fans on Discord, and most of it's just like the fans talking amongst themselves, and that's pretty cool. So people have talked about some people they might want to have on for interviews and some topics for discussion. There are some secret fans of Evil Games Club lurking about.
How is it allowed? Like that's not right.
I can't.
Yeah. Well, we're nice, so we're not going to kick anyone out.
We're trapped.
Yep. We didn't call ourselves Sorta Nice Games Club, which would have left the door open for us
to. Yeah, it's arms.
And then, of course, the debate that I mentioned earlier, is it ludum dare or ludum dare? And also, of course, the ongoing debate of whether it's GIF or JIF. But
how,
these
how
are
to pronounce Godot,
some of,
and there's
Godot or Godot or
who knows anymore.
These are fun conversations you can get involved into on our Discord.
Which you can reach at where, Stephen?
Nicegames.club/Discord.
Correct.
Okay, good. I got it right.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
So, Ellen, you were saying?
The transition was so smooth, and then I just didn't quite nail it because I'm laughing too much about that. Ridiculous. Oh, boy. Okay, so I mentioned this on the show often enough, but I'm a learning experience designer by day and a podcaster gamer person by weekend. And as part of like the ongoing reading and knowledge gathering I try to do for my day job, I've been reading a book called Educating Intuition by Robin M. Hogarth. I'm not making very quick progress, but that's okay because this book is so incredibly dense. Like, it is packed with lots of really interesting things, and it's very, there's a lot in here, mm-hmm. a lot of good words, a lot of good ideas, and that's probably one of the reasons why I'm so slow getting through it. Also because it's hard to dig in your garden and read at the same time if you're trying to read a paper book. Right?
Yeah, I imagine, you know, holding a giant rock in a book at the same time is a little tricky.
No. Rock takes full attention.
Right.
I'm just imagining like a small library buried underneath all the rocks in your garden now.
Have you been over to my house? We'll have to edit that out just for security. Yeah. So anyway, it's an older book. It was published in 2001. But I think it's still relevant. It's not research, right? It's not a research paper. It's not an academic text. It's kind of like more of a pop sci work. Although I wouldn't say that it's written in the style that today's pop sci works would be. So if you end up picking it up, don't expect it's going to be like Moonwalking with Einstein. It's not that kind of like story centered. Book. But it is really interesting. And one of the things that we're talking about that Hogarth is talking about in the beginning of this book is, what is intuition and why do we feel like it's so important to us? Why is there so much discussion about it? How does it lead to decision making? And I became really curious about how this idea of rapid decision making or intuitive action relates to gameplay. So that's what I wanted to talk about a little bit today. The first thing I want to talk about a little bit is what we mean by intuition. And there are going to be some links to some short YouTube videos that we're going to put in the show notes that kind of take different approaches to this. One of the things that phrases that I came across that I really liked was adaptive unconscious. So it's not reasoning that happens with your conscious attention. It's processing that happens unconsciously and then has a result. So the way that Hogarth talks about it, paper sounds. He proposes that he thinks the essence of intuition is that intuitions or intuitive responses are reached with little apparent effort and typically without conscious awareness. They involve little or no conscious deliberation. And when I was thinking about, like, that's how a lot of the decisions we make while we're playing a game are made. You're just doing it. Like, if you get stumped on something, then you maybe will stop and think about it. But I usually get stumped on something after I've, like, just gung-ho try to do it a couple times, you know? Yeah. Like, I'll just flail around a little bit, and I won't stop and actually consciously think about what I'm doing until I've made a few, intuitive attempts at solving the puzzle or whatever and haven't succeeded.
Sure.
So that's kind of the first thing that comes to mind with me. I don't know. I'm curious. Is that resonating with you guys? Is that
no, like, that's super good. Cause like, I think that's something that like you, like it's really good specifically for like tutorialization and like getting people to learn a thing is like, you can try to exploit what people's like intuitions are and you, and actually trick them into learning something.
Yeah. Or, you know, and that's one of the things I wanted to touch on today, was like using or being aware of intuition and making sure that you're playing into it when you want to, and maybe playing against it when you want to.
Right.
Because I think playing against intuition might be a way that you can create some novelty.
Yeah.
But playing, you know, there are certain things that you, where you want to lean into intuition, like interface. Because if you play against intuition with interface, people are going to get frustrated because the interface isn't the game, right? The interface is the way that your players are interacting with your game. And so your interface, you probably want to follow conventions and lean into intuition. Whereas with your game, you're going to play around with it some more.
I was thinking about puzzle design, like that idea of when you were saying you try something intuitively before you stop and think about it. One of the things that in designing puzzles and playing puzzles, it's frustrating when it lets me try some stuff, right? Yeah. It lets me intuit it because it's not going to work because there's no way I'm going to intuit the solution. But it kind of gives me the impression I can. And then I bang my head or my character against a wall for a little while. And then I got to stop and really think about it. Then it feels a little bit like I wasted some time. Whereas if the game was could be much more upfront about now's the time to stop and think. But that's a real challenge, right? Mm-hmm. To like play against the intuition, like in the design.
Yeah. I don't know. What do you think, Steven?
No. Okay. I think the first thing
that comes to you.
Respond intuitively.
Yeah. No, I think it's part of the thing is that like everybody has a different intuition. It's not really something you can exploit it if you like know your audience really well. And that's kind of hard to say too, because like, you know, your audience, everybody in your audience is going to be different. Even if you know your audience really well, they're still gonna like, you know, get into it a little differently. But I think like, it's just kind of hard to actually use it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Steven, this is an opportunity to repeat your mantra, which is playtest, playtest, playtest.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You can get a better understanding of what people might intuitively do.
Yeah. What's human intuition versus player intuition versus genre savvy intuition versus individual intuition, right?
Yeah.
You can sort some of that out with some testing.
I'm again reminded of the first time I played Verdant Skies, where there's that part where you're walking in and I think the character's name is Jade. She tells you, don't touch anything. Don't go into this room. Just come straight to my office. And me, being the rule follower that I am, immediately went into her office. Whereas I think most people, when they played the game, they went around and touched stuff because they felt like that was an invitation to do the exact opposite of what that person told you to do. And so they figured out how to like customize the character and stuff. And so when I came back and I played through it and stuff, and I came back to Beth and I was like, how do I change my character? I couldn't figure out how to do that. And she was like, you could just go to the mirror and customize your character. And I was like, I was told not to go anywhere. I was told to go straight to the office.
That's a great example.
Right. So like in that instance, my intuition was to just follow the directions. But in other cases, like I think a lot of players will experience this. You're playing like a platformer or something and you land like, and there's a split and you can go left or right. I think a lot of people went into it that like right is the way you're supposed to go, because oftentimes platformers go from left to right. And so if you're a player that's interested in exploration and stuff, you'll go to the left because you're like, well, there's going to be some hidden stuff over there and I'm going to go find that stuff. But you know, you can use that to your advantage if you expect people to do that, and you can actually hide stuff in there. Or you can, you know, like have players waste their time and go to the left and there's just a dead end.
Yeah.
And then you go, ha, 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 you know. And sometimes that's fun.
there's an example of this in Widget Satchel that I designed for the very last level, which is a auto-scroller where you're on a platform that goes down, 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 down. and the path you're on the paths split. So when you pick a path, you can't pick the other. And so you just want to get the most widgets going down because weight doesn't matter anymore because there's no need to jump. And you're falling so fast that you can actually jump higher than you would in previous parts of the game. So it's a little bit of a fun reward for the player for sticking with it. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of places where sections repeat. And it's almost a little bit of a gag where the path that has widgets versus the path that doesn't, it toggles back and forth. But then the next time you encounter it, the game knows you knew how it worked before. And it starts off with the alternate. So you're like, okay, so this one's reversed. But it's actually not. It's both are on the left instead of one on the left, one on the right. And and that plays with the player's intuition. And the lesson I wanted players to learn from that was that you can't know this until you try it. And so look for a way to try it again. And so it's meant to motivate the player to find the door to go back up there and go through another way to get all the widgets. I don't know how successful it was, but that was the intent, is to play with the intuition of the player.
And to
make it, you know, hopefully it didn't feel entirely like just a prank on the player.
But that's good though, because like you used the pranking that I was, you know, suggesting people could do to like try to teach players like try to get players to do something that like they might not instinctively try to do otherwise. And I think that's cool.
Well, that makes me, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned all these things, because you know, intuition is going to interact with all the different layers of gameplay, like the interface, the mechanics, the dynamics, aesthetics. Everyone's going to bring their intuition to that experience, and everyone's intuition about playing the game is going to be informed by everything that's crammed into your unconscious, right? Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that we're starting, that, you know, Hogarth is starting to get into in the section of the book where I am, is where does intuition come from? And it's something you can train, right? Because a lot of your intuition is based on your experience. Again, it's unconscious processing. So everything that you do as a player across multiple games is going to shape your intuition and your responses, those unconscious responses that you're having in the moment when you're playing a new game. Mm-hmm. So you're bringing that history with you. So if you've played a lot of platformers, you're probably going to go left and check it out because you know there's probably a secret over there. Maybe there is. Maybe it's that type of platformer.
Yeah.
And if there is, then it confirms, yes, this is this type of platformer. And that's going to shape your intuition for the rest of the game.
Right.
But even beyond just the first few seconds of a game, or like the tutorial level or the onboarding, you as the game designer are shaping the player's intuition about how that game works itself.
Right.
So, you know, the intuition about there might be another door coming at the end of the Plinko level, right, where you're falling, the auto-scroll level, is going to be present for players who've done some exploration earlier in the game and found a lot of those secrets and extra socks. It's more likely to occur to those people because their experience has primed them to you know, intuitively look for those things or intuitively think of those as possibilities.
Well, this also involves really a level of trust too. Like it's a powerful and dangerous tool, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing just to bring over a little bit more instructional theory into the Nice Games Club podcast. Thinking of that, the progression of a player's ability is like thinking of a person's progression from unconscious incompetence to unconscious competence. I'm not sure if I've ever talked about this with the podcast before, but if I have, it's been a long time. So we'll go through these again. So whenever you're on the on the path of starting a new thing, the first place you are generally is unconscious incompetence. You don't even know that you're bad at it. When you start trying to do the thing, then you realize that you're pretty bad at it. You know that you're bad at it. You have conscious incompetence. Then you start to gain some skills. And as you practice those skills, that set of skills moves from conscious incompetence to conscious competence. So you know that you can do the thing, but you still have to think about it a lot. Mm-hmm. You know? So like you ask you ask me to do a cartwheel, and I'm going to say I can't because I am consciously incompetent about that.
Yeah.
If you taught me how to do a cartwheel, first of all, someone should pay you because wow. And Second of all, I would always still be in the very, like, the conscious competence area. I could do a cartwheel, but I'm probably never going to practice it enough to be able to just, you know, bang out a cartwheel without thinking about it. Like, I'm going to have to say, okay, put my feet this way and my hands this way and don't hold your breath, or maybe hold your breath. See, I don't know. And then do your thing. But you talk up to an Olympian and you say, okay, you're an Olympic gymnast, do a cartwheel. They just do a cartwheel. Yeah. Like, they wouldn't have to think about it to the level of detail that I would. They'd be able to kind of operate in that adaptive, unconscious sphere.
Well, we've all heard the phrase, it's like riding a bike.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. Exactly. If you learned how to ride a bike, you've gone through these stages. I mean, if you learned how to do anything, you've gone through these stages. If you've gotten to the point where you are, like, comfortable just doing the thing.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Have you, has anyone ever receded from conscious unconscious competence to conscious competence? Has anyone receded?
Okay, I think good. So. I think that's pretty common. If you don't keep up on your practice of a skill, then you're going to, we call that getting rusty, right?
Yeah.
Your skills get rusty. So, like, when I was in college, I played the trombone. When I was a music major, and I decided not to be a music major because I didn't like to practice. but I was very good at the trombone. Mm-hmm. I haven't played the trombone in a long time. And if I picked it up, I bet I could make it sound really good, but I'd have to really think about it. At least for a while, until probably for a couple hours until I settled into it again.
Right. I really like the saying, you know, it's like riding a bike, because I forgot how to ride a bike. And had to relearn how to do it. So,
you're asking just to, like, am I normal?
sounds like I am. Yeah. And I imagine that's the case for a lot of people too.
Mm-hmm.
How can we use this instructional learning?
Well, I think you can think about that in terms of you can think about the gameplay and the mechanics and the like the things that you're teaching your player to do throughout your game within those quadrants. And so when you're starting a game, your player is starting the game and they don't know anything. They are consciously incompetent. They know they aren't good. However, depending on the level of experience that your player has with maybe your genre of game, they might actually really quickly get to a level of unconscious competence with certain mechanics, right?
Sure.
So, like, within 2 seconds of me starting a game that has a jump mechanic in it, if that uses a button, like the A button or the space bar to jump, I don't need any more practice. I instantly know how to jump. I don't have to think about it. The only thing I need to do to teach myself how to jump in a game like that is just press the button and see what happens.
Yeah.
Because once I've confirmed that space bar is jump, I'm set. I can jump. Got that.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with, like, running left and right. How does that work? So I think you don't, even as a designer, you're going to be using those conventions. But when you're introducing the things that are maybe more novel, you are going to need to stretch that period a little bit more, for players if it's not something that they're used to doing. Whether they're new players or new to the genre, or it's something that you're deliberately putting in there with a twist.
I've seen a lot of playtests of games where it has a different way of doing something, and it makes a lot of sense. And the designer gets really frustrated when people don't pick up on it, because it's not that complicated.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I didn't expect to have to do a bunch of tutorialization, because it's really not that complicated. And I think this is the dimension that hits on. It's like, it's not that people don't get it. It's not that people don't even consciously understand it. It's that like, they just are resistant to adapting to it. Without that little extra runway that you're describing.
Yeah. Well, and I think that for players, players want, you want to get to the point of unconscious competence, because you want to just be in the gameplay reacting to what's happening.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, like, solving the thing or being focused on the next thing that you need to do. And so when there's something that, when the game gets in the way of that, that in a way that isn't fun, or, like, it introduces something new, but then requires you to use it in a way that, like, you aren't ready for because you haven't reached that unconscious competence level, that can be frustrating, I think, for the player, too.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get around that? Think about it, play test it.
Yeah. Steven, all this has fighting games written all over it.
I know, right? Yeah. I can't stop thinking about fighting games. Because, like, yeah, the total thing you're describing, I think a lot with a lot of fighting games, it's gotten a lot better over the years. With a lot of earlier fighting games, like, they didn't have a good... There are a lot of things that were not intuitive because fighting games were new, novel. and so, like, it was difficult for people to pick up on those kinds of things and understand, like, all of those kinds of things. But as you play fighting games and as you, like really any fighting games, you start getting a better understanding of what it is you are supposed to be doing in a fighting game, and it becomes more intuitive as you play them, even if you don't necessarily understand the game. Like, I will oftentimes, if I'm playing a new fighting game, like, I don't play a lot of anime fighters, but whenever I play an anime fighter, what I will do is that, because they're very complicated, that's why I don't play them. And these are fighting games. Fighting games are already complicated. When I do one of those things is I will find a couple of moves that, like, make sense to me and I can understand what they do and what the purpose of these moves are, and I will use those moves a bunch. And then maybe try to experiment with other moves as I, fight more people or playing the game more. Because then I'll be like a decent level of competence. Because I'll know how I can use these moves to my advantage. And then, like, as I'm playing the game, I can start learning about more things and my moves that will expand. And then I'll be able to eventually get to the point where if I want to do a thing, I know what move I need to do that thing. And I won't have to think about it. It's exactly what you're describing, Ellen.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing.
A lot of the mechanical action becomes intuitive and you can focus more on the strategic parts of, you know, whatever it is you do in fighting games.
Yeah. fight. It's mostly fight.
Oh, yeah. Hit things.
Yes.
One to come like completely 180 degree different example.
Yeah.
Puzzle games do this too. Like the one that really came to mind was The Witness.
Oh, sure.
Where it slowly is training you to intuitively look for, like, just lines in the environment along different planes that you're not used
to.
Intuitively, when you start the game, you're not looking for those connections on those different axes.
Yeah.
And then over time with practice in the game, then your intuition learns that there are different ways of connecting things that don't line up with how things work in the real world, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it takes practice in the game to get to that point, because coming into the game, you have a lifetime of intuition built up around how things connect on different axes and planes out here in real life.
Yeah.
Given, namely that they don't. So I think that's a cool example of, like, playing counter to intuition that people are coming in with, and then using that as that experience of, like, retraining your intuition to operate differently within that game space.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. This is, I love this, because it's like learning a language. You're just, like, learning how to communicate in a new way. And I think that's so cool, because that's what I love about video games.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. That's good stuff.
Yeah. Without a single word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't have to be click here, click there.
Yeah.
It's just doing, like, one little connection, building the intuition of the player up a little bit at a time. That's the process of them learning how to play your game.
Hey, that's our show. Check out our website, nicegames.club, for show notes and links to resources on today's topics. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode and on our programming in general. Go to nicegames.club/feedback and tell us what you think. You can also get in touch with us directly on Twitter at nicegamesclub, where Dale tweets about game dev resources and choosing a variable name. Or you can email us contact@nicegames.club. You want to support the show? There are so many ways. You can give us a review in your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends about your favorite episodes. You can join us on Discord by visiting nicegames.club/discord. And we are now on Patreon. As a patron of the show, you'll enjoy bonus content, extra jokes, and more, including something we're about to record today that maybe you can just take a peek at if you join us at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
Yeah, and then before you know it, you're speaking French. You didn't even realize it.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, yeah.
S'il vous plaît.
Omelette du fromage. That's all I know.
What did I say?
I feel like we hit a really good end point to this topic maybe a couple of lines ago.
Probably.
This definitely seems like the post-roll funnies.
Yeah. Suddenly you're speaking French. I love it.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.